Edward Palfrey, reel 9. Your experiences on HMS Newfoundland must have been very different from previous ships you've been on.
Yes, indeed, they were considerably different. HMS Newfoundland was employed on the Far East Station in peacetime. And that is, of course, a very different role to that in wartime. Nevertheless, we still did a lot of gunnery practice and training of one form or another. And it was quite a busy commission because a lot of our time was spent in company with a number of other ships. And so from purely the signals point of view, it was quite busy. And one of the highlights of the commission was that we went to Australia on a cruise of 13 ports of Australia and New Zealand. And it was scheduled to take, I think, something like 9 or 10 weeks. In the event, after the first weekend at Fremantle in Western Australia, a place that we didn't particularly like, although the climate was good, but it wasn't a particularly nice place, we had a signal to tell us we had on board Vice Admiral Durlacher on board the ship for the cruise, and we had this signal from Commander-in-Chief of the fleet saying that Newfoundland is to return to Singapore at full speed because of an emergency in Kuwait. Now, what had happened is, as soon as we got to Fremantle, Vice Admiral Durlacher had flown on to Melbourne. And for us to go back to Singapore, we had to get the Admiral back on board to take him with us. We had left Fremantle and we had gone quite a long way towards Melbourne when the signal arrived. I remember it arrived about 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was simply said to return at full speed to Singapore, take on war stores, and then to the Persian Gulf for an emergency in Kuwait. So we had to arrange for the Admiral to fly back to Fremantle. We then steamed all the way back there through the Australian Bight, which is a very rough part of the sea. And we picked up the Admiral, and then we went back to Singapore, flat out, took on some stores there, painted out all the brasswork which the staffs had religiously polished for the last year or more, or many years perhaps. And then we went off to the Persian Gulf. It was so sudden, it took a few days, of course, it took several days, but the morale of the crew was very low. The hospitality which had been laid on for the ship's crew in Australia and New Zealand was quite phenomenal. And of course, all this had gone by the board, as it were. We arrived in Bahrain, and we remained at anchor there, I think, for something like 3 or 4 weeks, just swinging round, as it were, in the anchor. And to improve the morale of the crew, the captain had the idea that we would have a beard growing competition. So everyone on the ship ceased shaving. And I think I'm right in saying that after the third day, one of my messmates had won the competition. His name was Khan, K-H-A-N. And he walked away with the competition after 3 days. Anyway, most of the crew then were encouraged to keep their beards, because it was later learned that whether it was as a bonus or as a sop to the crew, but the news was released that we were leaving the Persian Gulf and going to Japan. And in Japan, the men don't grow beards. They don't have facial hair, very rarely. And so for a lot of sailors to land with beards is quite unique. Anyway, I kept mine for about 2 months, I think. But the trip to Japan was very good. We went to about 3 or 4 places there. Wonderful country. Very expensive. I remember we were ashore there, the canteen manager and another shipmate and myself were ashore, and we wanted to use the toilet on the way back. And they don't have any signs saying toilets, everything is in Japanese. So we decided we'd have to go into one of these clubs. There's clubs everywhere. But I remember it cost us each £1.06, or the equivalent of, just to go through the door to use the toilet. But that did include one drink. And of course, I suppose it was assumed that if you had one drink, you'd stop and have more. But we weren't in the mood. We were on the way back to the ship. But the Newfoundland was a very efficient ship. We had some wonderful sports teams. We had a captain whose reputation came ahead of him, Arthur Richard Heslett, a top submariner. I got on very well with him. He's still alive, so he may hear this one day. I got on very well with him indeed. But then I left that ship a little earlier than was originally expected, because I was selected for a tactical communication instructor's course at HMS Mercury starting in April of 79, would it be?
57?
Sorry, 59. 59. And so I flew, I transferred by Jack's Day to the destroyer Cavalier, the one that is now a museum ship. And then...
What was that like? It must have been...
Well, the Cavalier, I was only on board for a couple of hours. I didn't enjoy it one bit. Too much vibration. And the destroyer's life would not have suited me at all. My brother had served on the Cavalier, incidentally. But anyway, I only was going back into Singapore. Then I flew home by Britannia Airways on a 19-hour flight to London. And then I came up to HMS Mercury to qualify for a tactical communication instructor during that year, 56. And then the following year, the powers that be decided that I would stay in HMS Mercury and be the instructor for the following instructor's class. I think that's the only time that's ever happened, and I quite enjoyed that. Having completed my time in HMS Mercury, the next thing was I went to Malta. I was posted to Malta in December 60, and I stayed there until April 63. I was sent out there as an instructor in the Joint Tactical Center. That's where all the captains of ships and chief yeomen and yeomen go for their war training in a in a school where they learned tactics. And I also, in my spare time, was employed as an instructor in the Tactical Communication Centre, which trained signalmen and yeomen and all that for. So I had a good 2 years and 3 months out there. The only problem in Malta was in the summer, we would start teaching at 7 in the morning and pack up about 2 in the afternoon. And long before 2 in the afternoon, it was a job to keep the people awake because they were so hot.
Did your family go out with you?
Yes, my family went out with me, and they quite enjoyed it. My children went to the Telhandlet School at the other end of Valletta, the other side of the harbour. They quite enjoyed it, and I think one or two of them have been back there since. I haven't. And then I came back from Malta in March 63, and less than 2 months later, a year later, I should say, I then went to HMS Albion, a commando ship, at Singapore. And she was engaged in, I went to the Albion, in Portsmouth. Spent a few months on board in Portsmouth doing various aspects of training. And then went to the Far East to relieve HMS Bulwark, which was the other commando ship. And then we did 18 months in the Borneo confrontation, running from Singapore to Borneo. We did do one trip, I think, to Japan, and perhaps maybe twice, I think, we got as far as Hong Kong. The job of going to Borneo was that of taking various regiments. We took the 2nd Battalion, the Scots Guards, to Borneo. And a funny thing happened with about the last load of equipment that went over. We landed all the troops at the other end of Borneo at a place called Tawau, which was right at the far end. As far as I was concerned, it was the world's end for me. I thought it was awful. Anyway, we had this incident. One of the helicopters taking a net full of equipment and so forth, one of them was carrying the company's records. And something happened and the records were all ditched in the sea. I've learned since that the Army keeps duplicate records, and I suppose the Navy does too, for that matter. We only had one major mishap in Borneo when one helicopter crashed and the five people on board were killed. We had a couple of deaths on board. One was a midshipman who was accidentally killed in the hangar. We had a large party for local children at Labuan, and the ship was moored or anchored about a mile from the shore. These kids came on board and they were given a right royal party on the deck. And when all the equipment was put back after they'd gone, there was some midshipmen helping the sailors put the stuff back. And the midshipman was standing in a wire cage, which was getting things brought from the lift. The lift was down a little bit and everything was being dropped into this cage. And the midshipman was in there when the thing was moved, and he got his head caught and he was killed that way. Very sad. I was the one chosen to lay a wreath when he was buried in the sea. Very sad occasion it was. Anyway, the HMS Albion was one of the best ships I ever served in.
Why did you say that?
Well, we had some wonderful sports teams. The first captain we had, Captain John Adams, he was promoted to Rear Admiral. Wonderful man to work for. and he was relieved by a very famous man, Captain Basil Place, who was the last holder of the VC. And I got on very well with both of those captains, very well. And I was therefore very sorry to leave the ship, which I did when we came back to England.
What was the accommodation like?
The accommodation, as far as I was concerned, was quite good. The chief petty officer, the senior chief petty officer's mess, had about 30 in it. And that was right forward. The large mess, a little bit forward from us, was the petty officer's mess. They had about 140, 150 in that. But I was in what they call the head of department's chief's mess. And for most of the commission, I was the mess president. So that was a sideline. And needless to say, I ran a good mess. We had a good crew in there, very good. We had a bar, which people did use quite frequently. We were rationed to 6 pints of beer a day. I sometimes didn't see the bar, but when I did, I had my share. And it used to be quite good fun, really, because when the soldiers or the Marines were on board, the senior members were invited to use our mess, and it was part of my duty to be present, to greet them and speak to them and make them feel at home, and that was that. But we did take, we took several units to Borneo. One was the Scots Guards, the 3rd Australian Regiment, the Green Jackets, the Gurkhas, 2 Royal Marine Commandos, and of course when they were on board, they were in different messes to what we were. None of them were in our mess, but the senior ones, the regimental sergeant major and the company sergeant major, used our mess, but didn't cause us to be overcrowded or anything. The messing arrangements on there were very good. The next...
Were they bunks that you set in, or hammocks still?
They were bunks. The next mess to us was what we called the Tiffy's chief's mess. All the artificers and the chaps who get made a chief, you know, an ERA-3 or something as a chief in the Navy. And the chief ERA, of course, he's the senior man. The chief ERA was in my mess. But the other ERAs and tradesmen like that were in the next mess. There were about 80 of them. We got on very well with them because both messes, both of the chief's messes, used the same dining hall, which was a cafeteria just behind their mess. The messing arrangements were very good. Very good. Quite a good ship, the Albion. A very useful ship. Most useful ship probably in the Far East Station that I can recall. Because they would pick up the... We'd pick up the Green Jackets at Penang, take them all the way to Borneo, land them in comfort, look after them on the way there, let them use plenty of water on the way back, and so on. And incidentally, mentioning Penang, when the Albion went in dock in Singapore for about 6 weeks, 7 weeks, we had just taken over the Green Jackets regiment. And when they went over, the colonel of the Green Jackets obviously was chatting to the commander in the wardroom and said, well, we've vacated Penang Barracks for this trip. We've only left a few people behind to look after the place. Your crew, the commander, was obviously saying that it's not really nice living in a ship in dock because lots of things are off, the air conditioning and all that. And the colonel suggested we use Penang Barracks as a leave centre. Commander thought this was a good idea. And in fact, he spoke to me because I was also the chief petty officer's representative on the welfare committee, among other sidelines. And he said, would I like to go up there and run the leave centre for the crew? You've got nothing to do in dock. I said, well, you better talk to the captain about that, sir. I'd be quite happy, but you better clear that with the captain, which he did. And so I drove a Land Rover to Penang, spent 6 weeks there organising bus trips and all sorts of things for the sailors who were up there, barbecues and banyans, lovely, lovely. I didn't think much of Penang myself, but they did. They thought it was wonderful. So that was HMS Albion.
You said you had a number of sidelines.
Pardon?
You said you had a number of sidelines, including being on the welfare committee.
Oh, yes. I was always... I've always been interested in doing things like that. I was also the ship's representative for the Royal Naval Benevolent Trust, so that if one of the wives at home got in some sort of difficulty and she contacted the Royal Naval Benevolent Trust and the member, her husband, was on board the ship, I was the one who liaised with them to see what could be done to help them. I did that for a number of years. It all makes for the spice of life, getting involved in everything. So when I'd finished the Albion, and then I came back, and we're now reaching another stage of my life when I went to HMS Mercury from January 67 to March 68. I was there as an instructor, and I was also the mess president of the chief's mess up there. I left the Royal Navy on the 24th of April, 68.
Can you tell me about that time? How did you come to leave the Royal Navy, and did they help you make any preparations for returning to civilian life?
Well, when I was the president of the Chief Blood Elsewhere Mass, I had a phone call from the House of Commons from one of the chief radio supervisors who had previously left Mercury about 9 or 10 months before. Perhaps a year before, and he said, the Sergeant at Arms staff requires another doorkeeper, and we, the people who are up here from HMS Mercury, the communicators, want another communicator. So he said, will you advertise the job for me? I said, yes. I said, but I doubt very much if we'll have much of a response. I said, because they're all got too long to do or something in the Navy. And the first person I spoke to said he would be interested in applying. He did apply, and he was accepted for the job. But in the meantime, he had a draft to a ship at Portland, and he thought that by leaving the Navy suddenly, which he could have done at that stage of his career, he thought that he would get a bad name because he was due to go to a ship. So he declined to go to the House of Commons, so that job still remained vacant. Anyway, this chap kept ringing me, and he said, if you can't get anyone else, he said, what's wrong with you applying? And I thought about it, and thought about it, and I thought, well, I had about 4 jobs lined up, so I thought, in different places. And the only one that really appealed to me was Cheltenham, where the where all the cryptography goes on. I thought I'd like to go there.
The HQ.
Yeah. That's the place where they wouldn't allow unions, wasn't it?
That's the one you mean?
That's the one, yeah. I also had in mind Dover Port Control Station. A lot of our mess members had gone there. I thought of the signal station in the dockyard here, but there were about 300-odd steps in a spiral to get up there, and I couldn't fancy doing 20 years climbing up there. And the other one I had was the Coast Guard. And I applied for the Coast Guard and got details. And unfortunately, there was a misprint in the details that I had read, and the salary wasn't enough for me. So I then applied for the job at the House of Commons as a doorkeeper, and I was accepted for that. There was method, really, in my madness, because I needed, at that time, I needed lots of time off at school holiday times because I had 3 children to look after and no wife. So I had the two elder ones were in boarding school at great expense. And the other one was looked after during the week by a friend in where I lived at Clanfield. And I was able to get long holidays during the holiday periods for school. Well, that was fine until I'd been there about 6.5 years when I got promoted, and then my hours changed. And instead of having a long recess, I had to go in perhaps twice a week for all day. So although it was a better job, it was more demanding. But it was ever so interesting, that job too. The doorkeeper's job is quite unique because their job is very varied. They look after messages, mail from the members' lobby, issue it to the MPs when they arrive in to go into the chamber. They look after the various parts of the chamber, the press gallery, the strangers' gallery, the special galleries and all that, supervising the public and guarding the entrances to the chamber so that only MPs or officers of the House can go in there. And they also do other miscellaneous jobs like sitting in committees to represent the Sergeant-at-Arms while the committee meeting is going on. Theirs is a very interesting job. But the one that I got promoted to was even better. There, the job was allocating seats in the gallery, allocating tickets in advance, liaising with the embassies, the various ministries around London. Each ministry has a parliamentary clerk, and one deals with them, the embassies, high commissions and all that. It was a very interesting job. One used to often meet people that one would never meet in other positions. And although it was shift work, and more demanding shift work, because it was a different ship every day for 3 days. I mean, when I went to work at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I never knew what time I was going to finish. Officially, I was finishing at 10 o'clock the next morning, but being as I had to start again at 10 o'clock the next morning, we used to finish at 5, and the bloke who should have been in the night before, he had to come back and so forth. It was very, very mixed up.
Did you find it difficult to adjust to civilian life after so many years in the
service? Not at all, because I was working immediately with ex-servicemen. The qualification to get a job as a doorkeeper used to be a warrant officer or equivalent. Lots of chief petty officers and senior Royal Marines worked there. A lot of them I knew anyway. And my best friend there was a guardsman. He worked with me shortly after I got there, and we became friends, and he was about my best friend there, really. So I soon settled down. I had no problem at all. I thought that I might miss when I left, when I retired. My wife was very concerned. She knew I was always busy up there. She was very concerned that I would perhaps be at a loss when I retired, but I didn't. I didn't miss the place at all. I missed the people. And about the most significant thing that happened while I was up there was in the first 18 months or something that I was there, I was a very junior doorkeeper, and there was a postal strike, which everybody thought was going to be over in 2 days. I and the person in front of me, who had joined, were assigned to run the members' post office while the postmen were on strike, and we were in there for 7.5 weeks. And in the end, we had about 9 other doorkeepers helping us. Such was the avalanche of mail that we had.
Edward Palfrey, Reel 10.